form of obstruction. Fan rumbled a laugh, gave him a stinging slap on the back, and then another. On a nearby bench, Old B and Miss Lu were sharing a cigarette, entranced by the workers' radio broadcast, read by a young woman with a heart-shaped face and a soprano voice. Sparrow went outside and onto the square. Conditions had deteriorated. The students looked bedraggled and destitute. There was garbage everywhere, and the camp smelled very bad. One after another, people scrambled up to the microphone, identifying themselves as teachers, intellectuals, or student leaders. He watched for a long time. Their speeches, "No kneeling!" grew increasingly vehement, until, driven by their passions, "No compromise!" and by the high tide of emotions, they too finished by asking the protesters to stand firm and risk everything. "No retreat!" The sky opened, and heavy rain broke free. Tarps collapsed onto the huddled students, and he heard them cry out, a mix of laughter, groaning, and cursing. Banners drooped, flags stuck to their poles. A pair of abandoned shorts and a few wet T-shirts sat like turtlebacks before the portrait of Chairman Mao. Sparrow saw a tall girl standing alone, a pink headband in her hair, and wondered if it was Ewan, the neighbor's daughter. The rain blurred her figure, and he felt he was looking into the past, or into a future that would not arrive. He heard footsteps behind him and turned. Fan was running towards him, a graceful hop-skip-jump-jog, holding a bright blue umbrella like a prize in the air. He was assigned to the blockade at Mu Si Ti Bridge, which was so close to home it was like watching over his backyard. Sparrow and a dozen neighbors took up a position on the roof of a city bus whose tires had been punctured. Songs from the 1920s and 1930s proliferated around them, and neighbors, including Ling, handed out candy nougats, tea, and pastries. All night, he followed Ling's figure in the crowd below. She was distributing copies of an unauthorized supplement to the People's Daily, printed covertly by the newspaper's staff. In the last week, Sparrow had hardly seen her. Ling was never home. She had thrown all her energy into the ongoing dispute at Radio Beijing. Journalists and editors, including Ling, had come down firmly on the side of the students and were no longer waiting for official approval before broadcasting their reports. The Ling he had first met in Kai's room, the sharp-eyed philosophy student, had been biding her time, and here she was now, as if she had never been away. In fact, all over Beijing, people who had seemingly resigned themselves to always wearing 10 layers of coats were now shedding them all at once. They carried themselves differently. They were proud, even joyful in bloom. Battling sleep, Sparrow found himself remembering the swaying of the Wuhan bus, when he and Kai had gone in search of Comrade Glass Eye, when a red-cheeked girl had fallen asleep in Sparrow's lap as he played Bird's Eye View. He, too, had felt purely happy then. The music had seemed to scour everyone clean. Perhaps the messages of the students had done something similar. Simplified ideas had set in motion a train of desires. A slogan on a headband, or a T-shirt, "Give me liberty or give me death," had led to a hunger strike and a political impasse, and both the will and desire to change one's conditions. On the second night, Sparrow was told to bring a cotton mask, towels, and handkerchiefs, because the army was expected to use tear gas. And yet, the next morning, the People's Liberation Army started up their convoys and began reversing out of the neighborhood. The exhausted soldiers waved as they departed, some weeping and others laughing. Bright ropes of flowers flooded the streets they had left behind. On Saturday, Aiming came home breathless, jubilant. She said that the students had entered into discussions with the government and agreed to a full withdrawal from Tiananmen Square. "Yiwen is coming home," she turned to Sparrow and said. "You don't have to sit on that broken bus anymore pretending to be a fighter." When he touched his daughter's cheek, Sparrow felt almost harmed by the softness of it. "Will you eat at home tonight, Aiming?"
"I'll even cook, and you'll be sorry you asked."
Ling went out to buy groceries. The news of the students' decision had not yet been broadcast, but in the alleyways, everyone seemed to know what had occurred. The streets vibrated with a hopefulness she had not witnessed since the first years of the Republic, as if all the years between then and now had only been a hallucination or a detour. Returning home, she ran into Yiwen's father at the water spigot. Yiwen had not been home since the start of the hunger strike, yet it was her father, Comrade Zhu, who had lost so much weight. Seeing Ling, he said,
"These children, ah, you give your life to them, and they crush your heart."
Ling took out the good cut of beef she'd bought and gave it to her neighbor. He lifted both hands, refusing.
"Take it," she said. "The students have called off the demonstrations. Now you can welcome Yiwen home."
Water overflowed the bucket, and Zhu turned the tap off.
"You see how it is," he said, accepting the gift and beckoning her into his flat. "We sacrificed everything so that Yiwen could get a good education. She's our only child. When Yiwen was accepted into Beijing Normal, I held the letter in my hands and wept. The first time I had wept in 40 years. I thought I might have a heart attack. Yiwen is the first in both our families to go to university. She's smarter than anyone I've ever known. I tried to make her understand how fortunate she was to be born into this time, to have opportunities we never had."
He shook his head.
"But these kids think it's all up to them. They have no understanding of fate."
He took a container from his icebox and gave it to her. It was a chicken already marinated. She tried to refuse, but he wouldn't hear of it.
"Perhaps it was us," Ling said, picking up where they had left off. "We understood fate all too well."
"Ah," he said, "you're right about that. Our children have stood up. And now it's we, their parents, down on our knees and begging forgiveness. But okay, okay, whatever. Look."
And Zhu pulled a small badge from his pocket.
"I even joined the Beijing Autonomous Residents Federation. You should join too. There are all sorts of initiatives under discussion."
Late that night, Radio Beijing announced that the students had overturned their own decision. They had decided to stay in the square after all, until the party conference scheduled for June 20th. The date jolted Sparrow. It was the same day he was scheduled to fly to Hong Kong to see Kai. The radio also announced that General Secretary Zhao Ziyang, who had already been removed from his post, had been stripped of all remaining duties and placed under house arrest. Through the window of the little office, he saw Aiming and Yiwen sitting in the courtyard. They were holding hands and looking up at something in the sky. At the stars, he thought, or at the helicopters. Maybe one could no longer be untangled from the other.
his sonata for piano and violin, the first piece of music he had written in 23 years, was finished. He could do no more. He made a clean copy, signed his name, and wrote the date, May 27th, 1989, and the title, The Sun Shines on the People's Square. He put the copy in an envelope to send to Kai. He wished to hear it performed, and he remembered how, despite his protests, Zhu Li used to play all his half-finished pieces. When he looked over the music, he couldn't shake the feeling that it had come from someone else entirely, or more accurately, that it had been written by himself and another, a counterpoint between two people alive and awake, young and old, who had lived entirely different worlds. Outside were the usual voices, rainfall, laughter, a radio, sirens, good-natured bickering. But here in this room was music that existed in silence. In the Shanghai Conservatory, he remembered paintings showed musicians playing the qin, a silk-stringed zither. Only the qin had no strings, as if, at the moment of purest composition, there was no noise. Sparrow had never made a sustained sound. The music came in beginnings and endings, like the edges of a table. The life in the middle. What was it? Zhu Li, Kai, himself. 20 years in a factory, thousands of radios, a marriage and family. Nearly all of his adult life, the day after day, year upon year, that gives shape to a person, that accrues weight. He saw himself putting down his pencil and standing up from the desk. He saw himself walking out of this room, this alleyway, this city, without turning back. The following morning he woke early, put on his uniform, and returned to work. Chapter 3. As I waited in Shanghai, one life unexpectedly opened the door to another. 3 days after I met with Tofu Liu, he telephoned me. His niece at Radio Beijing had put him in contact with someone I should meet. Lu Yiwen, the close friend of a Radio Beijing editor who had passed away in 1996. This was the same Yiwen who had known Ai Ming and her parents in 1988 and 1989. I felt the impossible had occurred. I had plucked a needle from the sea. Tonight, June 6, 2016, I went to her flat on Fenyang Road, near to the Shanghai Conservatory. Yiwen was a tall, strikingly beautiful woman in her mid-40s. She wore jeans, a t-shirt, and sandals, and her long hair was tied up in a loose knot. She spoke with an intensity that I found riveting. She was restless. She made large gestures as she spoke, as if she were drawing on a screen. We spoke in English. After graduating with a degree in Chinese language and history from Beijing Normal, she had overturned her life and applied to study electrical engineering at Tokyo University. To her surprise, she had been accepted. She had only returned to China the previous year. She was divorced and had a teenaged daughter. Yiwen had much to tell me. A story is a shifting creature, an eternal mirror that catches our lives at unexpected angles. Partway into our conversation, I opened my laptop and showed her a scan of the composition. The Sun Rises on the People's Square. I began humming the notes. This is Sparrow's music, Yiwen said immediately. But how do you know? He was singing it all the time. I used to hear him in the evenings, walking home late at night.
In 1989, we lived in the Musiti Hutong. All the flats were small and very close together. We were living almost one on top of the other. Sparrow would pass by my window on the way to his flat, and I could hear him in the little study where he used to do his writing. His music was like something in the air.
Yiwen leaned closer to the computer.
But how on earth did you get this?
A friend performed it for me a few years ago. I've learned to read the music a little.
But how did you find a copy of the music? It was destroyed in 1989. Ai Ming had only 9 pages. I saw it destroyed.
I told her that Sparrow had sent it to my father in a letter dated May 27th, 1989. That I had only found it a few years ago in a Hong Kong police file. It had been among my father's possessions when he died.
Yiwen became suddenly emotional. Ai Ming thought it was gone.
Do you know where Ai Ming's mother is? I've tried to find her, but the address I have...
Ling? But she died in 1996.
A wave of emotion gathered in me. I had always suspected Ling had passed away, yet still I had hoped. I thought for a moment, collecting myself. Ai Ming had a great aunt who used to own a bookstore. She was very elderly.
The old cat. She lives in Shanghai. She turned 100 this year, and when you ask the year of her birth, she says she's been alive forever. I'll write down her address for you. She doesn't have a telephone.
Yiwen continued.
In 1996, Ai Ming came back from the United States.
Sometime in May, I said.
Yes, mid-May. She came to Beijing for her mother's funeral. The situation was difficult. Her U.S. visa had never come through, and she didn't have a Chinese hukou, a residency permit any longer. She took a risk and went to the Public Security Bureau to request one, but they denied her. I saw her a few times while she was in the city. Her mother's death was unbearable for her. Ai Ming wasn't well. She told me she was going to live with her grandmother in the south. Later on, about a year later, so 1997 or 1998, she wrote me a letter. She said she was going to Gansu province in western China. She asked me to come with her. I was living in Tokyo at that point. I asked her if she was kidding. Why in the world was she going to the desert in the middle of summer? All I wanted was for Ai Ming to come to her senses, to see reason. But I said things. I was extremely harsh in my letter. I said too much. I never heard from her after that. It must have been early 1998. The dates matched my own. The things I felt were inexpressible. I was young. I didn't understand. Everything that happened during the demonstrations, the way it ended, the way people died, had left me angry and cynical, Yiwen said. Ling's death changed everything for Ai Ming. Actually, after Ai Ming went away the first time to Canada in 1990, I became very close to her mother. I admired Ling and saw how courageous she had been. I began to see my life in a different way. She was the one who encouraged me to apply to the University of Tokyo. Ling made it possible for all of us to start our lives again, but she herself never had the chance. Yiwen stood up and went out of the room. When she came back, she carried 2 items. The first,
a picture of Ling, Sparrow, and Aiming, taken in 1989. They were standing in the center of Tiananmen Square. The second, Chapter 23 of the Book of Records, which Aiming had copied out and given to Yi Wen for her 20th birthday. "I didn't know how Ling was connected to your family in Canada. I only knew that a lot of letters went back and forth. But Aiming never told me the details, even when she came back in 1996. "And Ling, she never told you?" I asked. Yi Wen looked at me searchingly, as if I was the one with the answers to give her. "It was just the way life was back then," she said finally. "People lost one another. You could be sent 5,000 kilometers away, with no hope of coming back. Everyone had so many people like this in their lives, people who had been sent away. This was the bitterness of life, but also the freedom. You couldn't live against the reality of the time, but it was still possible to keep your private dreams. Only they had to stay that way, intensely, powerfully private. You had to keep something for yourself, and to do that, you had to turn away from reality. It's hard to explain if you didn't grow up here. People simply didn't have the right to live where they wanted, to love who they wanted, to do the work they wanted. Everything was decided by the party. When the demonstrations began, the students were asking for something simple. In the beginning, it wasn't about changing the system or bringing down the government, let alone the party. It was about having the freedom to live where you chose, to pursue the work you loved. All those years, our parents had to pretend. To see the future in a different light takes time, but we thought everything could begin with this first movement. We sat in silence for a moment. The notebook, Aiming's handwriting, Chapter 23, felt both real and weightless in my hands, so near and so far away. "What made you decide to come home?" Yi Wen set the notebook on the table, beside a photograph I had given her, showing Aiming, Ma, and me in 1991. "The first movement is finished. You will never come back again. But Marie, how can I put it? It might be finished, it might be over, but that doesn't mean I've stopped hearing it." Just recently, I began listening to the transcriptions and reimaginings of Bach's music written by the Italian pianist Ferruccio Busoni. These albums had been part of my father's music collection, and now they are part of mine. 300 years separate the births of Bach and Busoni. Yet, I find these transcriptions intricate and terribly beautiful. Why did Busoni transcribe Bach? How does a copy become more than a copy? Is art the creation of something new and original, or simply the continuous enlargement or the distillation of an observation that came before? What answer would my father give? In 1989, when he left my mother and me, he waited in Hong Kong for Sparrow to come. I was so young when he abandoned us. The regrets he carried can never be known to me. I fear to imagine his suffering, and yet the details I know will not leave me. Pills and drinking, my mother was later told. A debilitating depression. Gambling. Perhaps he felt that what had happened to Sparrow must be his fault somehow. That the Hong Kong visa, the travel papers, the ticket had made Sparrow a target. Of course, it wasn't true, but Ba couldn't know that, and he came to what seemed a logical explanation.
He had betrayed my mother and me, and didn't know how to go back, to become what he was. Sparrow, Zhu Li, the professor, his own family, they were gone. All the selves he had tried to be, everything that he had lost, could no longer be denied. My father loved Sparrow, almost all of his life. Of this I have no doubt. It was early in the morning, still dark, when he went to the window of his 9th-floor room. He climbed out. Nobody looked up. Nobody saw him. He was entirely alone. I understand that he wanted to stop his heartbreak, no matter the cost, and to end the enormity of his emotions. Maybe he hoped we, his family, would forget. But my mother and I, waiting in Vancouver, held on to the person we had known. Ma had truly loved him, the part of him that he had shown her. Many lives and many selves might exist, but that doesn't render each variation false. I don't believe so. If he were still alive, that is what I would tell him. I know that throughout my life I have struggled to forgive my father. Now, as I get older, I wish most of all that he had been able to find a way to forgive himself. In the end, I believe these pages, and the Book of Records, return to the persistence of this desire, to know the times in which we are alive, to keep the record that must be kept, and also, finally, to let it go. That's what I would tell my father, to have faith that one day someone else will keep the record.
Chapter 2. Monday and Tuesday felt like a single continuous day in Sparrow's life. Production had slowed to almost nothing. Old B and Miss Lu were listless, and Thaurin looked as if she was dismantling radios rather than building them. But Sparrow felt glad for the distraction of work, and actually surpassed his quota for the day. Music joined all the movements he made. It slid between his thoughts like a staircase reaching in multiple directions until he was nothing more than a sound. Around him, conversation continued. Rumors and truth crumpled together. Someone said that the People's Liberation Army was planning a coup. Ms. Lu reported that police had arrested a dozen members of the Iron Mounted Soldiers, who had renamed themselves the Flying Tigers. Old B said that high-ranking generals in the army had been purged, and that new battalions of the PLA would re-enter Beijing tonight.
"Tomorrow," Ms. Lu said.
"Never," said Fan.
Meanwhile, in the square, Hong Kong entrepreneurs had donated hundreds of brand-new tents, and the students had erected a statue, the Goddess of Democracy. A new open-air forum, the Tiananmen University of Democracy, had been inaugurated the previous night. On Wednesday, Fan did not arrive for her shift. By Thursday, the temperatures were reaching 40 degrees, and the wires in Sparrow's hands felt alive. On Radio Beijing, a powerful member of the standing committee said that the youth were good, pure, and kind-hearted, and were not the problem. It was the workers, in particular, the leaders of the Autonomous Union, who had created a cancer cell made out of the dregs of society. But where was Fan? On Friday, Old B came in late. His normally neat and clean hair was damp with sweat, and he had to smoke three of his big front gate cigarettes in quick succession before he could tell them what had happened. Old B described the crowds in front of the public security office on Tianmen Avenue.
"They've been arresting people all week," he said. "So I went up there to find out what had happened to Fan. These bastards asked me why I was looking for a counter-revolutionary, a political criminal. They said, 'Run along home before we arrest you too.' 'Oh, really?' I said. For what crime? Comrade, you're in violation of martial law. Fuck me, I said. You're in violation of the Constitution.
Old B took out another cigarette.
Idiot that I am. I was wearing my ID card on my shirt. They wrote everything down.
Miss Lu yanked the cigarette out of Old B's mouth.
You shouldn't have gone by yourself. You have no self-control.
Sparrow poured him a cup of tea.
I'm going back tomorrow,
Old B said, grabbing back the cigarette.
They can't arrest us all.
That night, Sparrow called Cold Water Ditch. Big Mother Knife was out of breath from being summoned to the neighborhood phone. After she had huffed for some minutes, she told him that the student demonstrations had spread to Shenzhen and Guangzhou. When he asked if she had joined the protests, she shouted,
"Deng Xiaoping and those old farm tools in Beijing should retire. All those old men, it's like they breathe through the same nostril."
Beside Sparrow, the caretaker of the phone, Mrs. Sun, was smoking and pretending to read the People's Daily. Her children clambered around her like sparks going off. On the other end of the line, Big Mother had grown quiet, and Sparrow thought she was done speaking. He was in the middle of saying goodbye when Big Mother interrupted to tell him she had news. Last week, she had received a letter from Aunt Swirl and Wen the Dreamer.
"Ma," he said.
"Don't interrupt,"
she shouted, and then sighing.
"I'm getting old. I keep losing my train of thought."
Now Big Mother filled in the years, speaking rapidly, as if she were running across a narrow beam.
Back in 1977, Wen had nearly been arrested. If it weren't for his friend, projectionist Bang, they could never have gotten away. They had retreated deeper into Kyrgyzstan. Last year, word finally reached them that Big Mother's petitioning had been successful. During the reforms initiated by Hu Yaobang, the convictions against Wen the Dreamer had been overturned, and his criminal label had been removed.
"It only took 10 years, Big Mother said bitterly.
Swirl and Wen were coming home. In the letter, Swirl said they'd already crossed Inner Mongolia and reached Lanzhou. After nearly 20 years in the desert regions, they wanted to visit the sea. They planned to stop in Beijing before continuing on to Shanghai and Cold Water Ditch. Big Mother had already given them Sparrow's address, even though it would be another few months before the official paperwork reached them. He should expect them in the winter.
"Will you recognize Swirl?"
his mother asked.
"Always," he said.
Sparrow shifted the phone to his other ear.
"Do they know everything that's happened?"
He feared he had inadvertently pushed his mother off the balance beam, and that she had toppled over and fallen into the quiet. But Big Mother's voice, when it came back, was steady.
"She knows. They both know."
Over the line, the faint echoes of other conversations broke through and fell back.
"My son, have you been writing music?"
Sparrow, surprised by her question, answered truthfully, "Yes."
"Well, what is it?"
"A sonata for piano and violin."
He wanted to tell his mother about an entirely different recording, Bach's 6 sonatas for the same 2 instruments. Throughout his life, Bach had returned to these 6 pieces, polishing and revising them, rewriting them as he grew older. They were almost unbearably beautiful, as if the composer wanted to find out how much this most basic of sonata forms, exposition, development, recapitulation, could hold, and in what ways containment could hold a freedom, a life. His mother sounded illogically near.
What did you name it? I hope you didn't just give it a number.
Sparrow smiled into the phone. He was aware of Mrs. Sun staring up at the ceiling at a particularly large spider.
I called it The Sun Shines on the People's Square.
Did you?
She gave a big, round pop of a laugh. He couldn't help but laugh as well.
Yes, I did.
You'll find a way to play it for Swirl and Win the Dreamer?
Of course.
It's a joyful title, isn't it?
His mother said. He nodded, surprised by the grief that overtook him. He remembered something Zhu Li had once said. Luckily, joy seeps into all your compositions. Some part of him had always existed separately. It had continued even after he had ceased to listen.
Yes.
The next day, Saturday, Ai Ming slept until noon. It was so hot, even the bed felt as if it were melting. Last night, she and Yi Wen had stayed late at Tiananmen Square, where the rock star Hou Dejian had given a concert, his voice reverberating up to Chairman Mao's portrait, like a dream they were all letting go. Now Ai Ming sat up, sweaty, nauseous, the whine of electric guitars pulsating in her head. She felt as if she had not slept at all. The racket of the helicopters continued. They were circling Beijing again, dropping pamphlets. She sat up. The calendar said June 3rd. The month of May had vanished, dissolved by history. Today, Ai Ming would copy Chapter 23 of the Book of Records as a birthday present for Yi Wen. This evening, she would go to Tiananmen, but she would come home early. She would have a good rest. At home that afternoon, Sparrow fell into a deep sleep that went undisturbed by the loudspeakers, whose broadcast repeated stubbornly, "Beginning immediately, all Beijing citizens must be on high alert. Please stay off the streets and away from Tiananmen Square. All workers should remain at their posts, and all citizens should stay at home to safeguard their lives." What did he dream? Later on, Ai Ming often wondered, because when Sparrow came out of his room around dinner time, he was calm, even elated. He was carrying a small bundle of papers that were taped together and folded accordion style. He sat down on the sofa beside Ling, oblivious to the broadcaster's repeated warnings. Perhaps Sparrow, like Ai Ming, did not believe that the army would re-enter the city. Sparrow was humming a piece of music, an enlargement of the pattern of notes he had been humming for weeks. Directly above him, the spring festival calendar showed two plump goldfish, good fortune gliding over his head like clouds. Ai Ming listened to his humming. The music was not a lament, and yet it had a lifting, altering sadness impossible to pin down. Ling was reading yesterday's paper. She stared, as if hypnotized, at the same page. Side by side, Ai Ming's parents appeared joined at the hip, although Ling leaned slightly away, as if to make space for another person. Ai Ming studied her father closely. His bad haircut had grown out a little, making the bird of quiet look like someone who had once been very handsome. She stretched out her hands. After 3 hours of copying Chapter 23, when May 4th arrives in Ho Hot and begins her journey into the desert, all the little bones in her fingers hurt. The noise of the helicopters was maddening, as if their only purpose was to agitate everyone's nerves. A sharp sound cracked against the windows, and then the door. She and Ling jumped, but Sparrow simply turned, as if he'd been expecting an intruder all along. A woman's raspy voice cried out, "Comrade Sparrow! Comrade Sparrow!" When no one else moved, Aiming went to the door and pulled it open. The woman had a narrow nose, surprisingly large eyes, and a small, pointy chin. What was the stain on her dress? Mud. Dried red mud. And she had a new bruise, very swollen, just below her left eye. "Fan," her father said.
"Sparrow, help us, please."
Fan was shuddering, as if from cold.
"Old B, Thalren, we have to bring them here."
Aiming stepped away from the door.
"They were hit at Gongzhufen. We have to hurry. The army is coming in."
She stared at Aiming with an unreal placidity, blank terror.
"Gongzhufen," Sparrow said.
Ling was looking at Sparrow's sheaf of papers. She had picked them up off the sofa and was staring at them, as if no one and no sound had entered the room. Sparrow went and spoke into her ear. Ling stood up.
"Aiming," her father said, turning. "Stay with your mother. Do you understand?"
"Yes," she said.
"You promise to stay here?"
She nodded.
"Aiming, promise me that you won't leave the house. I have to go now."
Why was he shouting? Or perhaps he wasn't shouting. He was speaking quietly, yet his voice seemed to be pounding in her ears.
"Yes, Ba."
He paced the room in a confused way, looking for something. His coat, his ID, the bundle of papers. A letter. Whatever it was he had wanted to bring with him, he abandoned it. He gave Ling one last look, a smile to reassure her, before hurrying after Fan. Aiming followed them to the door.
"She's a co-worker," Ling said. "She works at the wire factory."
Aiming saw her father's bicycle wobbling down the alleyway into the shadows. A vanishing color caught her eye, a pink dress, a flash of orange light. The stuttering vibration of helicopters made it impossible to think.
"Shut the door, Aiming."
She turned to find her mother beside her.
"Shut the door,"
Ling repeated, doing it herself. Her mother was holding that sheaf of papers, and Aiming saw line after line of musical notation, a language she had never learned to read. At the top, three words were visible.
"For Zhang Kai."
"He'll be home soon," Aiming said. Her own voice sounded silly to her, flattened.
"What do you know about it? What have you ever known about your father?"
Dazed, Aiming said nothing.
"Do you know he could have composed for the Central Philharmonic? He could have studied abroad. He could have had a different life. If only he was a completely different kind of person."
Ling shook the papers slightly.
"But he wouldn't be with us. He wouldn't have chosen us, would he? If he'd been given a choice."
The papers in her hands seemed to proliferate.
"Your father has always been a good man. But kindness can be a downfall. It can make you lose perspective. It can make you foolish."
Ling sat down on the sofa.
"Ma, why did he go with her?"
Ling said.
"Doesn't he know what's happening out there? Does he think that this life doesn't matter? Does he really believe that he can carry on as if he is invisible?"
At first, the gunfire had been intermittent, shocking, but now it came steadily, a drilling in the night. When Aiming could stand it no longer, she hid in the study, surrounded by her books, the collected letters of Tchaikovsky, the Analects,
The Rain on Mount Ba. In the courtyard outside, the scramble of voices grew increasingly frantic. Two hands rapped softly on the glass. The pink headband in Ewan's hair was as startling as daylight. Iming pushed open the window.
"Come out,"
Ewan whispered. Her eyes were wide. She'd been crying. Iming looked around the room. A pair of plastic sandals, her mother's, were turned over beside the book trunk. Iming slipped them on. She climbed onto the desk and dangled first one leg and then the other out the window. She felt Ewan's warm hands gripping her ankles, pulling her insistently down. She jumped. Halfway out of the courtyard, Iming realized she'd forgotten to close the window.
"Wait, wait, Ewan,"
she whispered, turning to go back. As she reached the window, she saw a figure hovering in the doorway, moving towards her. She told herself that the shadow was only in her mind. Iming pushed the glass closed.
"Iming,"
she heard.
"Iming, where are you going?"
She kept running.
"Iming, come back!"
These streets, covered with smoke, could not be hers. Iming's bicycle swerved around the debris. Overturned chairs, bricks that seemed to have come from nowhere, tree branches, abandoned cars, a wagon in which two children were sitting, staring mutely out. Behind them, at the Musiti intersection, she saw overturned buses and smoke billowing from at least a dozen fires.
"Ewan, where are we going?"
But the other girl kept pedaling.
"How could they?"
Ewan said. She was somehow both calm and distraught.
"How could they?"
She pedaled furiously, as if someone was chasing them. Small clusters of bicycles moved in every direction. A truck filled with boys, heading towards Musiti, swerved past. The boys shouted that they were on their way to the barricades. To her relief, Chang'an Avenue grew less chaotic as they approached Tiananmen Square. On and on the boulevard went, the sounds of fighting diminishing. The square rose before them. She saw the tent city, gray and sturdy against the concrete, and the goddess of democracy shining like a trick of light.
"We can't go back," Ewan said. "They're killing people at Fengtai. They're killing people at Gongzhufen. Right in the street, at the intersection. I saw it, Iming. I saw it. At first, it was only tear gas, but then there were real bullets. There was real blood. They're following people through the alleyways."
"Gongzhufen?"
"I don't know. I don't know."
Iming's legs kept moving, the bicycle rushing forward, but she felt as if she were falling.
"I have to go back. My father's at Gongzhufen."
"Are you crazy?"
Ewan was crying so hard she could not possibly see in front of her.
"They're shooting! The People's Liberation Army is shooting! I saw three or four people hit right in front of me. The bullets, it's as if they explode inside the person."
"No, the army wouldn't dare. They must be rubber bullets."
"They wouldn't?"
Ewan shouted, hysterical.
"People were crying, 'Why are they shooting at us? Why are they shooting?' And then they couldn't run away because of the roadblocks. Our roadblocks. All the roadblocks we set up. They couldn't climb over them."
In the square, an immense crowd of students was still gathered at the base of the Monument of the People's Heroes. Ewan's bicycle rolled to a stop.
"But what now?"
Iming whispered. Ewan was looking directly at her, but Iming had the disturbing sensation that she, Iming, was not really there. She saw stains on Ewan's dress, the muddy darkness of blood. Someone else's, she thought, her heart pounding. Surely someone else's.
What have we done?
Yiwen said.
What have we done?
Sometimes the army trucks burst forward without warning, heedless of who stood in the road. Every moment there were yet more soldiers and yet more people, as the ones trying to escape collided with those who had only been onlookers, or who had been standing outside their buildings, or had been on their way to or from work. Sparrow and Fan had run almost all the way back to Musiti, and they were both gasping for breath. In the alleyways, soldiers materialized as if they were born from the ground. The crowd was not running away, but only back and forth, like toys on a string. Electric buses, which had once formed a barricade, were now wrecks of charred metal.
"Don't let them pass," Fan was saying. "They're murderers! Don't let them get through to the square!"
Teenagers stumbled by, carrying an injured girl in their arms. A voice on a loudspeaker said, "Go home, go home." Someone was crying for help. The tanks came forward again. He heard the dull knocking of bricks against metal.
"Fascists! Fascists!"
Sparrow turned. Was it Fan? He couldn't see her. How neatly and quietly the soldiers had appeared behind him, shoulder to shoulder, their guns raised. But they walked past Sparrow as if he was not there. Behind them, a woman lay injured on the road. Two men ran and began to pull her backwards. The soldiers shot repeatedly at a single person he couldn't see. Fan was shouting,
"Animals! Inhuman animals!"
Smoke fell as if from the trees. The loudspeaker broke through the noise. "Go home, go home, go home."
"Little Guo, where are you? Little Guo?"
"He's hit! He's hit! Someone help us!"
Fan was supporting a man who leaned heavily on his shoulder. He was tall, heavy-set, and wearing a navy blue worker's uniform, and his full weight came down like a falling pole as Sparrow rushed to help. Stumbling forward, Sparrow feared he would bring them all down. He caught hold of something, a piece of metal. He pulled away as it began to singe his hand.
"Careful, careful,"
Fan mumbled, as if she were in a dream, as if she were guiding a line of small children across the road.
"Don't let them reach the students."
His hand felt as if it were melting. The man leaning against him said,
"Please don't leave me. Promise me, please. You can't leave me."
"I won't leave you. Tell me your name." The steadiness of Sparrow's voice felt unreal and far away. "Where did you get hit?" The blood had covered up the original wound.
"It's inside me,"
the man said, crying now.
"They did this to me."
Another person rushed over with a flatbed tricycle. Everyone was shouting. The wood of the cart was slick with blood and a thick grime. The big injured man was jostled in, alongside the woman Sparrow had seen earlier. Her eyes were open. They looked at him with a question. The driver began to pedal. They tried to help him by pushing the cart on both sides.
"Which way?"
the driver shouted.
"Which way?" "Go west! Get to Fuxing Hospital!"
"No, no! Get him over to the center, on Zhushikou!"
"Wait, wait! There are more people here!" Two more bodies were hurried into the cart.
"Save yourselves,"
the injured man moaned, feverish.
"Can't you see? They're shooting."
Sparrow thought of his bicycle. He would need it, but where had he put it? A man was pouring gasoline on a hulk of metal, crying, "Animals, butchers, down with the Communist Party." Smoke rushed into Sparrow's chest. It filled his throat and vision. He felt an anger that had seemed long gone, or had never existed in him before. Through the jostling crowd,
He thought he saw Fan and went towards her.
At the Musiti intersection, Sparrow found himself on streets that he knew, and he recognized familiar buildings and the houses of his neighbors, things that made him feel irrationally safe. The noise was overpowering, exploding canisters of tear gas, people shouting, petrol bombs flaring along the road, crawling up over the army tanks. A long vibration suddenly exploded somewhere near. If he closed his eyes for too long, rows of buildings might be erased, just as lines of people, too, were vanishing. The soldiers had been singing the words of Chairman Mao. If no one attacks me, I attack no one. But if people attack me, I must attack them. Sparrow walked towards the armored trucks, where soldiers moved in glacial, melting shapes. Kneeling, shooting, standing, creeping forward. Their olive-green uniforms, the hard shell of their helmets, seemed out of keeping with their young faces. Too young. They looked the same age as Kai and Du Li had been long ago. They walked impossibly slowly, as if the soldiers' bodies were balloons and their guns were made of lead. He heard the flat crack of a concrete block hitting an armored tank. Sound accelerated. One tank rushed towards the place he had been standing only a moment before. He thought he was still there, watching the tank grow larger. The people running appeared to be suddenly unmoving. All the shapes he saw became sound. The cracking of trees, the swinging of a rifle, the edges of a bayonet. He felt the whistle of bullets passing near, but the crack of the rifles was delayed. The noise coming a second, two, three, later. Sparrow did not know where Fan was. He recognized the closed storefront of a train ticket office and saw a couple huddled there. Loudspeakers above continued urging them to go home, go home. But PLA soldiers were coming out of their trucks and infiltrating the small streets and alleyways. The man was dressed smartly and had wavy hair and a thin face. The woman was carrying a small child in her arms.
"We have to go," the man was saying.
"No, no," she whispered. "We're trapped. They're shooting back there."
The surreal sound of a pop song was tinkling down from above. Someone had left a radio or a television on. Gunfire punctured the alleyway, making sparks of light. Sparrow wanted to protect them, but did not know how to give them the same terrifying invisibility that he seemingly possessed. The woman's dark hair gleamed wetly, and he saw now that a long stain of blood was moving from her hair, down her clothes, over the child in her arms, and dripping onto the sidewalk. The man was sweating. His dress shirt had the softness of an old newspaper.
"Give her to me," the man begged.
The woman refused, hugging the child closer.
"Why are they shooting?" the man said brokenly. "How can they?"
More armored trucks were rushing along Chang'an, as if they were late for an appointment further ahead.
"Don't be scared," the woman said to the motionless child. "We're almost there. Stop crying. We're almost there."
Now the trucks stopped, and more soldiers poured out.
"Fascists! Fascists!"
an old man shouted. He was wearing shorts and a white undershirt. He was instantly surrounded by three soldiers. Sparrow saw a teenager with a camera, the camera hovering in front of his face. The soldiers turned and shot him. Sparrow began to run towards the teenager, shouting. The soldiers kept firing. One came forward in a vicious motion and bayoneted the boy in the stomach. The teenager gripped the bayonet with both hands, screaming, trying to pull it out.
By the time Sparrow reached them, the soldier was gone, and the student was curled up on the ground.